21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. Because under love is a stronger emotion.
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer and Noah Dankner runs our board, rejoining us after, I think, many years without speaking to them. Friends of the Earth joins us. They've been at work since its founding in 1969. Over the past 40 years, Friends of the Earth have focused local, national, and international attention on vital environmental and justice issues, resulting in landmark environmental laws, precedent-setting legal victories, and the exposure of political malfeasance and corporate greed. Joining us this portion of our program is Friends of the Earth President Eric Pica. Eric Pica. Eric is recognized nationally as an expert on energy subsidies who for more than a decade has worked to reform U.S. tax and budget policy in ways that reduce pollution and spark a transition to clean energy. Prior to becoming Friends of the Earth's president in 2009, Eric served as the organization's director of domestic programs, and in that role, he designed and launched many of Friends of the Earth's campaigns, including efforts to bring emerging technologies such as nanotechnology and synthetic biology under greater public and regulatory control, and to reform, among other things, how the federal government manages and invests in our transportation system. Well, those are no little things. And what we're about to talk about, including the many campaigns, 12 different Friends of the Earth projects, we're going to get a general history of their organization from Eric. Thank you so much, Eric, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, you have a very varied background. In addition to being a trombonist and an organic gardener, I checked up on you.
Oh, what'd you find?
Well, that you are one of these sort of multicultural, multi-talented humans who have a love of the earth. Talk to us a bit about how you were brought up, because I also saw that farming and education has been a part of your whole life.
Yeah, no. So I grew up in Southwest Michigan. In a rural community. And, you know, my father was a full-time teacher and a part-time farmer. And so, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but when I grew up, you know, working on the farm, working with the soil, kind of being out in nature, kind of really heavily influenced, you know, my direction in life. And then, you know, my father being a teacher, I feel like, you know, environmental advocacy is very much about teaching. It's teaching people, teaching the planet, you know, people on the planet, how to do things differently that creates a more sustainable and just world.
Amen. Amen to that. So you were founded in 69 by David Brower, and now you have more than 2 million activists working with Friends of the Earth International in 75 countries. That's an extraordinary accomplishment alone. How do you manage with that many organizations and that many people what each group will do in each of their locations?
Yeah, so Friends of the Earth International, the best I can compare it to is United Nations, how we run and function. And so all of our organizations are grassroots driven, and you know many of them petition once they become of national importance to become part of Friends of the Earth International. And so, you know, our groups are as varied as the countries that we represent. And, you know, we do meet, you know, biannually to decide upon what are the international campaigns that we're going to run. And, you know, we set policy as well. For instance, one of the policies, you know, one of the major campaigns that we run is, of course, on climate change. But our members are far more interested in, you know, how the current global economic system is working and how it devalues life and the environment. And so we have a huge campaign run on fighting trade agreements, fighting against multinational corporations that are trying to buy their way into government. And I think it's unique as an international federation to have a campaign that's run on changing the neoliberalism capitalist model.
Mm-hmm. And it is true. You know, I've tagged this the death economy that we operate worldwide. And I've talked to economists about this view that I've had for 15 years. And if you look at it, it's on a war model. Everything is an acceptable risk strategy and everything is a commodity for exploitation, for profit. That's a death economy. A life economy, a life economy would do what you and I and most of our listeners would value, which is the choices we make would support life, not destroy life. We wouldn't be using Agent Orange in our agricultural fields, and we wouldn't have GMOs. We'd have biodynamic and organic farming, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a handy little term that I like to pass on to organizations like you, because it's a very simple way for people to look at their life and say, yeah, medicine's about death. And our insurance industry is about death, and our agriculture is certainly not about life, and it's and on and on. And it makes it very simple to evaluate, is what I'm doing leading towards life, or is what I'm choosing to do contributing to destruction and death? Anyway.
I'll have to start using the death economy, because I think that it absolutely, when you reward companies and individuals and even governments in a way that devalues life, devalues the environment, natural resources, you know, you are ultimately leading to the death of our society.
No question.
I definitely will start.
And the death of our civilization. I hope you do and pass it around internationally. I have found, I mean, I used to cover the IMF and the World Trade Organization, and I was a big whistleblower every day of the week on radio nationally. And after that decade, I kind of went running another direction because I was so broken by it. But I found that if it's an easy banner. And the other part of it, though, is life economy. You have to insist on a life economy. So if people can, in each of their countries, it's a really simple thing that everybody gets. And I'd love it if you'd use it.
We will. It's definitely something that I am piqued to start using some of your terminology.
Please do. Think about it. Death economy is what we have. We want a life economy. Okay, so you've described how enormous you are, like this UN of Friends of the Earth. How do you go about, though, deciding on the campaigns? And I ask this to every major organization I interview because that's a challenge.
It is a challenge, particularly at the international level. And so, you know, with our 75 sister groups, you know, we understand that, you know, fighting the economic model is important. We understand climate change. And then what ends up happening is, because we're so diverse and we're so grassroots oriented, you know, what ultimately ends up forming is affinity groups within Friends of the Earth International, where a set of a dozen groups will work on, say, taking on palm oil exploitation in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia. Or, you know, likewise, another group, set of groups will end up taking on the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal that, you know, that will impact U.S. trade with Asia, or even the Transatlantic Partnership, the big NAFTA-like deal between the United States and Europe. And so what ends up happening is that the groups, almost through self-selection, end up working together quite closely, including sharing staff, sharing financial resources, a lot of intellectual work. And then ultimately, it's great to be able to say that we're running a global campaign where we've got protests going on in the U.S., in Europe, and Asia, all at the same time on the same day. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real power of Friends of the Earth International.
That's extraordinary. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I think that, you know, the real power of our network is that, you know, we're able to deploy tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people simultaneously around the world, showing that the issues are not just country-specific, but they are truly global in nature.
No question. I mean, I am so impressed by the list that your organization sent me. So why don't we get to it with some of them, because I've covered some of them, not all of them, in many other shows. Your Bee Action Campaign, the bees of our planet and our pollinators are critical. Talk to us a bit about this one.
Yeah, so this one's an important one. Bees and other pollinators are responsible for about two-thirds of the foods that we eat. And, you know, there has been a steady decline in the number of pollinators in the United States and globally. And what we've determined, or what science is determining, not that Friends of the Earth has determined it, is that, you know, there are this increasing use of pesticides called neonicotinoids, which are nicotine-based. And, you know, they're pre-treated. They're used to pre-treat crops, predominantly corn, soybeans. And they're having a pretty dire impact on bees. The science is still evolving, but there's enough that we know from the Environmental Protection Agency and other independent science reviews that these neonics are impacting the bees in a way that's facilitating colony collapse disorder. And so what our Bee Action Campaign is all about is showing consumers, because these neonics are both within the commercial market but also in the consumer market, that, you know, they shouldn't be buying products that contain these neonicotinoids. For instance, you could buy a butterfly bush that is treated with these neonics. So instead of helping pollinators, you're actually luring them in to their death.
Well, and they call it bee-friendly labels, and they're not.
Yeah, they're absolutely not. And so this is Bayer Chemicals, Syngenta. You know, it's these companies that are producing this pesticide that is, you know, a fairly substantial profit center for them. While they're advertising as bee-friendly, you know, they're killing these plants. They're killing bees. And so what we've done over the last 2 years now is that we've gone to Home Depot and Lowe's, and we've hired scientists, and we've tested the plants that they're selling as bee-friendly and others, and we're finding that these neonics are in these plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've created tremendous consumer uproar at these big box retailers, and we're trying to force these neonics out of the supply chain. Simultaneously, we're doing a lot of work to pressure the Environmental Protection Agency to withdraw a permit. It's a temporary permit that these companies are using to be able to sell neonicotinoids. And so, you know, we're using
and increase their sales. I've been reading some task force papers. They're not only asked not to stop; they want more.
Yeah, no, they want more of these products out on the market,
mm-hmm.
And which is what, you know, what these chemical giants do, right? They create a chemical, this time a pesticide, and they convince farmers and the regulators that it's something that's good and useful, and then they start, you know, and then it gets distributed.
Again, it's the death economy's warfare agriculture, and it grew out of World War II. We've covered this ad nauseum for 30 years, and I, like you and many others, cannot believe here I am 30 years later, and while we have wonderful people doing organic farming around the world, the United States lags so far behind Europe in its awareness of good health for the soil and for human and animal life. And the next one that stands directly to show us how sick the USA is versus the rest of the world is genetically modified foods, or GMOs. This is one of the most important things, I think, in the world, because if we have a sterile seed supply, we have human death. We just have the death of the earth. So talk to us about the GMO food campaign.
Yeah, so there is a tremendous amount of work going on in the United States to help to start regulating and at least labeling genetically modified organisms. You know, Friends of the Earth has participated in three state ballot initiatives. If you recall, there was a ballot initiative in California, one in Washington State over the last couple of years, and then we just lost one in Oregon.
They finished the recount,
and unfortunately we lost by 800 votes.
It's extraordinary. That's after they eliminated 40,000 some that they saw weren't valid voters.
Yeah, and that was also after, you know, this was the most expensive ballot initiative in Oregon history, and Monsanto and Pepsi and a lot of the companies are part of the Grocery Manufacturers Association spent tens of millions of dollars on this campaign, and they only won by 800 votes, showing you that, you know, where the tide against GMOs is beginning to tip in the favor of people who want a sane food economy, and, you know, that want to know what's in their food right now. Unfortunately, what we're looking at is in Congress, many of these same companies are promoting what we call the DARK Act, which would be a federal bill that would prevent states from doing independent GMO labeling, which we think is key, and instead would create some voluntary standards. And we all know, I mean, we know what happens when you have voluntary labeling standards or voluntary standards kind of period, is that the companies find ways to mislead the American public into thinking that something's healthy and it's not.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I get tongue-tied like this very moment because I am so overwhelmed by the facts that we have and the lack of incentive that our Congress shows to do the appropriate thing for every human on earth, and yet we'll do the bidding of the corporations that stuff their friggin' election pockets and and sacrifice the rest of the world. I mean, the selfishness is beyond belief to me. Anyway.
Yeah, and it's gotten worse, right? I mean, Friends of the Earth started a democracy campaign a couple years ago because we've determined that we can't have successful campaigns unless we're directly dealing with how to reform American democracy, both in money and politics, how votes are counted, how people are registered, because, you know, we've just seen this tremendous erosion in the right to vote and counting votes over the last 30 years that is just preventing us and everybody else, healthcare advocates, immigration advocates, same fiscal policy advocates, you know, it's preventing all of us from doing the work that we need to do, which we know is better for the American people and for the global population.
Mm-hmm. No question about it. And states' rights is something I worked on for over a decade, a lot of my time. And it doesn't, I mean, while the federal government can pass a law that says states can't do what they choose to do, it's not constitutional. And every state has the right, and some states and their governors have challenged such edicts by the federal government. And I think the marijuana laws is a proof in point that the federal war on the citizens of the states is the longest waged civil war in world history. And that's what the drug war is. We'll be right back. Our guest is Eric Pica, P-I-C-A. He's the president from Friends of the Earth. We're talking about many of their current campaigns. I encourage you to join them. Go to their website, www.foe.org.
I'm Joseph Mangano. I'm Executive Director of the Radiation and Public Health Project. Our studies of the health hazards of nuclear reactors have found nuclear plants that close, we see an immediate drop locally in infant deaths and child cancers, and over a long period in total cancers. If you want to find out more about us and how you can help, please go to www.radiation.org. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. And Eric Pica joins us. He's president at Friends of the Earth. They do an extraordinary job worldwide and in the United States. And they have 75 sister organizations worldwide representing millions of people who are all working together on the good things that we all want to see for our good Earth society. The next issue you all are working on, we've done a number of shows on the Keystone XL pipeline, and we have a vote coming up in this next Congress that will tell us whether Obama has the power to hang in there with us or whether he's going to go along with Congress. Talk to us about the Keystone pipeline.
Yeah, well, the Keystone XL pipeline has been the six-year battle, which really started, many of us after the 2009 climate fight, as well as the failure in Copenhagen, were looking for ways to challenge the fossil fuel industry. And so the Keystone XL pipeline, which would connect the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, which is the dirtiest form of oil in the world, to the refineries in the Gulf Coast to provide Canada with export facilities. And so we saw this pipeline, and then Dr. James Hansen said that if the tar sands were tapped using the Keystone XL pipeline and other pipelines, that it would be game over for the planet when it comes to fighting climate change. Mm-hmm. And so Friends of the Earth, 350.org, the Sierra Club, many groups around the United States and Canada decided that we were going to draw a line in the sand and say that, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline is not going to be built. And so 6 years later, you know, a pipeline that at the time we thought was 100% chance of getting approved. Is now, you know, the president is saying the right things, or he's saying that this pipeline, you know, isn't really needed, and now he's fighting Congress, who, for some reason, and I think this is campaign finance reform, has taken a lot of money from the oil industry, and the oil industry, including the American Petroleum Institute and the TransCanada and Canada itself, have said that this is their number one priority, to build this pipeline to deliver tar sands to Gulf of Mexico.
Well, and as you point out, your organization does, not only would it cripple our water supply, it will also go through ancestral lands. Obviously, it cooks the climate. And you write that it will create less than 30 permanent jobs.
Yep. And so that's not even our assessment. So the State Department did a review, an environmental impact review, and they said, I think it's less than 50 jobs that it would create, which is rather ironic. Because, you know, in the Senate, we had a vote on the Keystone XL pipeline in December, and there were more senators that voted in favor of the pipeline than total permanent jobs the pipeline would create. Now, I don't want to dismiss the job, you know, we need to create jobs in the United States, but I think the real question is, do we create jobs that continue to create the death economy, or do we create jobs that create the evolution of how we use and produce energy in the United States using solar and wind. So I think that's what this real debate is.
Yeah, about. So the solar and wind would be the life economy.
There you go.
You are the man, Eric. You are the dude. This is great. Another campaign that lots of us don't think about because it's really prominent in South Asia, you mentioned it, which is the palm oil campaign.
And so the palm oil campaign is really, you know, if you look at climate change and you look at where a significant amount of greenhouse gas emissions come from, about 25% of the world's emissions come from deforestation. And as our food supply and our commercial food products have become more and more, I guess, consumer oriented, industry has been looking at food. The big food has been looking for additives to put in food, and they've been using palm oil.
Mm-hmm.
It's a plentiful oil that grows in, you know, it's a tree that grows in tropical rainforests. And so there's been a lot of illegal deforestation, a lot of use of palm oil in Southeast Asia and Africa, where companies like Vilmar have come in, basically clear cut the land. Vital native tropical rainforest, slash and burn, release a lot of carbon emissions, push a lot of the indigenous peoples out of the land to plant palm plantations to supply consumers with palm oil, which is used in consumer products, used in food products. And, you know, finally, you know, Friends of the Earth and many other groups around the world are saying is enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't have this illegal deforestation. We can't have indigenous peoples thrown off their land. And most importantly, you know, we can't be supplying palm oil to further this economy that is trying to create these cheap throwaway food products and consumer products.
You know, when I listen to you speak and I see the breadth of Friends of the Earth's campaigns, it's a beautiful demonstration of the will of several multiplied thousandfold. And I just want to thank you for not only being the president of Friends of the Earth, but for all the work your organization is doing in our country and worldwide. And for all of us that may not know about it, I'm hoping that tonight will at least help some people appreciate that there really are great people doing great things amidst all the horrors we face. And one of the things I like about your work is that you're so versed politically, and so often there's been a history of environmental activism, not from the organizations, but from local folks sort of not taking on their local legislatures. But the big ones, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership campaign that you mentioned, is really another significant sort of pass on pollution, passed off as trade, and the fact that they would keep the trade agreement away from the private being able to, rather from the public being able to see it, and only privy to corporations, seems to me somehow or other a demonstration of corporatocracy at its worst.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I have to thank you for providing us and Friends of the Earth with the opportunity to come on your show. It's been a wonderful conversation. So I thank you for that.
For sure.
And the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know what, and this is where we vehemently disagree with President Obama. Trade agreements, particularly the ones like the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Transatlantic Partnership, which are being negotiated on in both oceans, are perhaps the most important laws that nobody knows about. When a trade agreement is negotiated, it isn't just about tariffs, right? Like the trade of goods between two countries. It's about regulation. It's about how corporations can use trade laws to create a race to the bottom that once again creates the death economy, devalues life, devalues the environment to promote corporate profits.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Project, has more than 20 different chapters in it that include intellectual property, the environment, labor. And what all these chapters tell us, and some of these have been leaked out through WikiLeaks, and thank goodness for WikiLeaks, is that what the administration is negotiating, it's not for the American people. It's not to ease trade or to kind of remove barriers that make no sense. It's really to create kind of a supra-corporate law globally that puts corporate rights above both country rights as well as individual rights. And so this is, from an environmental perspective, this is one of the most important things that we work on because it's so encompassing. There's been at least, there's been several trade agreements that the United States has signed, with El Salvador, Costa Rica, Honduras, where the El Salvadoran government tried to stop a silver company from polluting one of its major water sources. It passed a law and said, no, you can't do that. And that company went and sued underneath a trade agreement that the United States had for them for the lost profits that they had already factored into their business model because the country wanted to protect its water source. I mean, this is the type of trade agreement that the United States is in the process of negotiating with Asian countries as well as with Europe.
And the worst part, though, I used to cover things like this, and it kept me awake at night because I would get so wound up and so angry, is that they want to fast track it, which means that there's really no intelligent discussion. Fast track, in my mind, is completely unconstitutional. But in any event, to try to push through a deal like this through Congress with an up or down vote and no review is exactly what they tried on NAFTA and GATT. But go ahead.
Yeah, no review, and they have no the first, the trade agreements are hard to get a hold of. They're underneath law where if you leak out the trade agreements, which is why WikiLeaks has done such a great service to the United, people around the world, is that you can be punished with prison time if you leak out trade agreements. If you happen to get them.
Well, just as a point of interest, I want to tell you, I think I'm the only broadcaster in the entire world who read the entire GATT agreement.
Yeah.
I actually read that million thousand pages. But anyway, so go back to how things have changed in the last 15 years that you can't get a copy of these trade agreements?
No, you can't get a copy of these agreements, the draft agreements. So, Congress then gets an agreement from the president, and if fast-tracked is approved, Congress passes it, basically they have a timeline, like 90 days for an up or down vote, no amendments, very few committee hearings, and it's, these laws could be, several thousand pages thick, because a trade agreement just isn't about trade,
no.
It's about amending every law that the United States has ever passed to conform with the trade agreement that was just negotiated in the dark of night by the president and the U.S. Trade Representative which happens to have over 850 corporate trade reps that serve as advisors to them. And so this is the danger, both Fast Track as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and how these agreements get negotiated and ultimately or not. I mean, we're fighting like hell to prevent this thing from happening from that passing.
Mm-hmm. And because it's so destructive to the environment and the livelihoods of peoples around the world, it's really about exploiting everything for corporate profit, which means it's a race to the bottom. And we saw that with NAFTA and GATT. I can remember reading just things about lettuce as an example. And we had to take Mexico's poison pesticide urinated lettuce, and we couldn't export our organic lettuce. So they take the least environmental law and make that standard, which is generally, as you point out, oftentimes voluntary enforcement by the corporation of the laws they've just finished ransacking in their agreement.
This is particularly if you're looking at, some of the Asian countries that will be a part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Their environmental laws are not nearly as robust as the United States.
Exactly.
And, within Europe, this is where we're really concerned about the Transatlantic Partnership. Europe is ahead of the United States in many issues, including regulating genetically modified organisms, chemical policy, climate policy. And so the United States is in the process of using the Transatlantic Partnership to erode many of the European laws that activists all around the country are using to force the United States to do better, better by its people.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of pushback is there from the European Union?
Well, I think they're from the European Union, they're mixed, right? You've got some really good countries that understand what the trade agreements do. But, you've had this kind of, over the last 50 years in Europe, this centralization of Europe within the European Union. And so I think many of those who want to continue to see this a stronger European Union see the transatlantic agreement as a way to kind of help the European Union grow collectively stronger. But also, I think that they see a permanent trading partner in the United States where, you have the two largest economies in the world linking together.
Mm-hmm.
And having that agreement and the economic agreement, particularly when it comes to natural resources like oil and coal and natural gas.
And water. Let's not forget the water that they're trying to privatize and corporatize all around the world.
Europe sees this as an opportunity for them to gain access to natural resources that the U.S. has.
Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable as I listen to you. We'll be right back. Our guest is Eric Pica. Eric is president of Friends of the Earth. We're talking about some of their current campaigns. You will be in such admiration of the great work they're doing for all of us, and I hope some of you will help them. www.foe.org.
My name is Jocelyn D'Ambrosio, and I'm an attorney with Earth Justice. Please feel free to visit our website, www.earthjustice.org, to learn more about the work we do to protect the environment and defend the right of all people to a healthy environment. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zohara Hieronymus.
Another great organization, Earth Justice, and we're joined by yet another great organization who works worldwide and in the United States with 75 different sister groups, and they're all working on really making the Earth a life economy that will sustain life. That's the goal. Eric Pica is our guest. He's president of Friends of the Earth, and we're talking about their current campaigns from GMO to saving the bees to the Keystone XL pipeline, palm oil, and many others. I'd like to touch, if you don't mind, because I have spent a good deal of my lifetime on the dangers of nuclear radiation. You all are working on the Diablo Canyon campaign.
Yeah, no, we are. It's not only Diablo, but we are working to create a nuclear-free California.
Bravo.
So several years ago, Friends of the Earth, right after Fukushima, we launched a campaign to start shutting down existing reactors. Friends of the Earth was founded in '69 basically as an anti-nuclear organization, mm-hmm. as one of our major campaigns. And ironically, Diablo was one of the reasons why we were founded.
Fascinating.
And so, you know, Friends of the Earth after Fukushima started looking at California and said, wouldn't it be great to create one of the largest economies in the world, you know, and reform it to be a nuclear-free economy?
And wouldn't it be great? Because there's fault lines out there, too.
Yeah, there's fault lines. There's not a lot of water out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like it was a good campaign. And so we started off and we started campaigning on the San Onofre nuclear reactors. There are two reactors in Southern California. And they had a release of radiation, radioactive material, and they shut down. And as they shut down, we started launching our campaign. And so a year and a half ago, San Onofre two reactors were permanently shut down. And so we were like, hey, we're two reactors down, two to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're starting we launched our Diablo campaign at the beginning, kind of mid-year 2014, with the whole seismic, you know, there's a lot of earthquakes in California, and Diablo Canyon happened to be built on three earthquake faults, and it's also not that far away from the San Andreas fault. And so we've launched a campaign. We're trying to convince the California Public Utility Commission, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is a fairly captured agency, that these reactors need to be shut down because there's too many people in the way of that live around the reactors if there was a devastating earthquake like Fukushima.
Mm-hmm, which continues to contaminate the ocean. When you comment all these things, I want to be sure to leave time for nanotechnology because I know it's something you care about and have spent a lot of time on. But President Obama talks about the all of the above campaign, meaning that we should do fracking. He hasn't quite totally said that in that way. Seems to be still a battle in each state. Though I'm glad to see New York says no fracking in our state. And I love the words they used. It's too, what did he say? Not risk. It's not an acceptable, I'll think of the word. But anyway, talk to us a bit about President Obama's efforts along these lines.
Yeah, well, we think presidential leadership should be about leadership. And all the above is really a cop-out. I mean, I compared it many times to, wouldn't it be great to take a final exam in college or in high school? And every answer was all the above, where you didn't have to make hard choices. And, you know, the president has acknowledged that we have this climate crisis that needs to be addressed aggressively. Yet his policies still promote oil mining on public lands, oil and gas drilling on public lands, the exportation of these fossil fuels to around the world. And so, you know, somebody has to call him out on it. And so Friends of the Earth has been highly critical of the president over the last 6 years about this idea that we can have every energy source that is known to man
mm-hmm.
and still address climate change. It just doesn't add up. And to us, it definitely is a lack of leadership.
Yeah, it's called a political cop-out.
it's not only a political cop-out, but, I've credited this administration for being kind of intellectually smarter in this. It's just not this. It's kind of a political cop-out, it's a moral cop-out, it's an intellectual cop-out.
Well, in all ways, and I think for those of us that voted for him, and I did, I was certainly hoping that there'd be a truly a more pro-life-friendly effort in terms of all of these things that are so obvious. It's not like we lack science. And this is the other thing I talk to all activists that I interview is we have the science to back everything you've said tonight can be backed up by science. And everything that the lobbies say is not backed up by science. It's backed up by make-believe. It's made by lies. And then they can buy the politicians because they have more money than we do. So one of the things that has come up before we touch on nanotechnology is the Green Climate Fund campaign.
Yep.
While we're talking about money, because it takes money to move from a death economy to a life economy.
Well, it does. And, what the Green Climate Fund is really about is, the United States has contributed over half of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. And as we talk about how to reduce and eliminate greenhouse gas emissions, we're going to ask developing countries of the world, particularly those who you know, who have been kind of pillaged by U.S. and European companies. We're going to ask them to kind of take a different development path, you know, when it comes to creating energy. And also mitigating, right? I mean, because these countries are also the ones that are feeling the early impacts of climate change. And so the Green Climate Fund is really about how do you provide monetary financial resources to those countries of the world that we're asking to forgo the development path that the United States took,
right,
but also that are forced by no fault of their own to adapt to a changing climate. And so we, you know, we think that, you know, the countries of the world should be given hundreds, particularly the wealthy ones, the United States, should be given hundreds of billions of dollars a year to these countries to help both pay them for the changes they have to make, but also to help them leapfrog us technologically.
Of course.
So that they're producing energy from renewable energies, and they're developing in a much more sustainable way. In a sustainable manner.
Exactly. And by contrast, I used to have all these figures at the top of my head. I don't anymore. We're going 15 years after the fact. But I used to cover how the cost of war versus the cost of rebuilding the world. And again, it shows us that we have a will to war rather than a will to live. And it's a peculiar breach of compassion and intelligence. And so that interests me. But
I mean, Iraq and Afghanistan, we spent several trillion dollars on those two wars. And yet, you know, what we're hearing from, you know, economists, that it would take only, a, you know, $1 trillion or $2 in capital investments in the United States and globally over the course of several decades to really fundamentally alter the course of how we use energy.
Exactly.
And it's really fascinating that we could spend, you know, that much money on war over the course of a decade, whereas we could use that same resources over the course of several and fundamentally alter the fate of humanity on the world.
Well, and that's why we are at such a critical juncture point for our civilization, not just our lives, but we're talking about hundreds of years in the future. And it strikes me as what we need is a spiritual education. You know, people need to have some way to feel a heart where they don't. I don't quite have the answer, but one of the things you all are working on is the nanotechnology campaign, and it's something, to be honest, I hadn't even thought about until I looked at this. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, and you know, I'll talk about kind of nanotechnology as well as synthetic biology
together, please.
Because what they end up doing is that scientists have figured out how to literally create matter and life from the ground up. So when you talk about spirituality, you know, what science is now able to do is to elevate humans to godlike status. And so with nanotechnology, we're able to manipulate matter at the fundamental particle quantum physics level. And so we can basically create any type of material with any type of property that we want. Synthetic biology is really kind of the opposite from a biological perspective. Scientists can now take the basic building blocks of life, DNA and RNA and proteins, and create life from scratch. And what, you know, what both of these two ideas have in common is that scientists have meticulously industrialized the cell as well as matter, to kind of really compartmentalize it, and with a belief that, you know, you can kind of with a very minimalist belief that you can control all the aspects of nanotechnology and synthetic biology and create new forms of matter and life that will be kind of more useful to humans. And the problem with this is that these scientists are so focused on this kind of minimalistic view of the world that they don't understand kind of the environmental, how life interacts with itself, and how matter interacts with life, and kind of the whole systemic view of what does this do to the larger world. And, you know, both synthetic biology, is just like genetically modified organisms, is not regulated by the United States or other the world government or global governments around the world, and nanotechnology is the same. We're still at least 10 years, if not more, away from being able to actually measure the toxicity of nanoparticles once it gets into the environment or into your body, some nanoparticles are able to cross the blood-brain barrier, which is a major kind of physiological part of how our brains stay healthy. And so, like, these technologies are really scary. In fact, you know, they're some of the scariest technologies and issues that I think we work on at Friends of the Earth United States.
When you think about how complex everything has gotten, on one level, the simplicity is pretty apparent, which is, again, the corporatocracy, the corporate nation, this sort of global view that everything is a commodity. The human body is a commodity. The earth is a commodity. The animal, everything. Everything is exploitable for profit. From your own life experience, Eric, what helps people change that point of view?
Wow, the more we talk about it, I mean, I have to, and I think you feel the same way. Like we have to have this kind of positive feeling that we can change the world by changing individual minds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been amazed by, you know, the innovation in renewable energy, right? Where people are now actively talking about getting solar on their roofs or wind energy, when you start talking about health, the health impacts of genetically modified organisms or nanotechnology or pesticides, people get that and start worrying about it. I'm really kind of with deep hope and desire. I think one of the most powerful movements in the country right now is the slow foods, local foods movement that is now cropping up around the country. There's real political power there because people are internalizing what they take in. They're saying, but I can't eat this because it's not organic. It's got all these preservatives in it. And frankly, I don't know what's going to do with my body. I think that, you know, the more we personalize this, the more we talk about these issues in a deeply personal way, and in a values-laden way as well, the more people get it, they understand it, and they become mobilized and become activists. So I'm still, like, kind of, despite all the danger signs and warning signs that are out there, I'm still quite hopeful, just given the amount of change we've seen over the last 5 years on many issues, including renewable energies and food supply, that we will eventually get on the right track and that the momentum will become such that it will be impossible to stop us.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. May it be so. I mean, you know, as I mentioned, I'm 61 and soon, in a few days, and I started at 14 handing out flyers for a Ralph Nader protest on acid rain. That's how far back it goes, if you can remember that, how that was an extraordinary thought to everybody. Oh, really? You mean all these metals and everything are raining down on us? It's like people were like, whoa, what do you mean? But I think the average person now doesn't think of the environment as necessarily something that's outside themselves. And that's what politicians and corporations have been able to maintain, which is this separation, this bifurcation between us and our world, as if we stand in it like a plastic model and it is just a stage. And it seems that more and more, as you point out, my own children, you know, have interests that, thank God they do, like, as you pointed out, the slow food movement or eating organic foods. Leave us with some closing thoughts about your organization, how people in our listening audience, we have about a minute, can make a difference.
Yeah, so Friends of the Earth, I mean, our mission is simple. We champion a healthy and just world, and we believe that you have to have justice in the world, economic justice, social justice, racial justice, in order to have a sustainable environment. Our website is www.foe.org, and we welcome. We have lots of information on our site. We've got about 500,000 followers and members in the United States. So become part of our organization.
I encourage everybody to go to www.foe.org. So grateful, Eric, you've joined us. Our guest has been Eric Pica, president of Friends of the Earth. Get involved, whether it's the bees, GMO, Keystone Pipeline, palm oil, cruise ships, nanotechnology. Take care of your neighborhood.
I hope you have more happy ever afters. I hope. And we can all live more fearlessly. with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio.